Welcome to the Art Scene, brought to you each week by UALR Public Radio. I'm Anne Nicholson. This week is a memoir we have heard before, but is well worth repeating, to hear how a young man walked for 2 years as a companion for the Dalai Lama. He tells it simply, but listeners can be caught up with the telling. Pico Iyer, brought up in Oxford, followed an unusual path. Okay, this book, On the Road, The Open Road, published in 2008, is absolutely fascinating to hear or to read about your connections with the Dalai Lama. And I just wondered, what decided you to put into print your sort of memoir of a wayfarer?
Two or three things. I think first that so many of my friends were asking me exactly the same question you just asked. And they said, you've been lucky enough to have access for 30 or 35 years to this man that by whom the whole world is so fascinated. So please, why don't you share some of the things that you've learned from him or seen in him? And I thought that since I'd fallen into this blessing, I might as well share what I knew of it. And I think even more urgently, at the beginning of this century, because I travel a lot across the globe, I felt that the world was more polarized than ever before. And I began this book actually just as the war in Iraq was breaking out. And I thought that we were crying out in some ways for a voice of inclusiveness and some human bridge between a world that seemed not to understand its other parts.
Yeah. Well, we can get into that in a minute, but I wanted to ask you one or two things, such as, did you keep a record? Did you have notebooks, tapes, videos, a camera? How were you able to record and write down for yourself from the beginning, going back to where the two, your father and the Dalai Lama, met back in, you know, forward from there? For example, in what you call the conundrum, rather provocatively, you bring the two young men together and joined serendipitously, perhaps, through your father's interest in Gandhi. And this was in 1959, just 12 years after partition. So yeah. Gandhi's death would have been still very fresh in so many minds. And your father had been born in India, was educated in his post-elementary days in Oxford, had a lot of the British education system behind him, and the two young men met and obviously clicked. And I wondered, just asking you how your father wrote a book called The Glass Curtain, and it was dedicated to a 3-year-old Pico. And the words that in your book relative to what your father said at the time made me wonder, because he said virtually that in his generation, this would dedicate to the note, bring to the notice to a little boy called Pico, and to those of his generation for whom there will be no curtain. And I wondered what your thoughts were on that, because to me, the curtains are still there.
Yes, well, that's a wonderful question with many chambers. And to answer the beginning of it, I've been a writer for Time magazine for 27 years. So I've got into the typical journalist's habit of keeping a record of everything that I see and hear. So that's how I covered the most recent quarter century. But you're absolutely right. The first scene of the book, which is my father's meeting the Dalai Lama 50 years ago, as soon as the Dalai Lama had come into Indian exile from Tibet. The way I was able to do that was partly my father wrote a long account at the time of his meeting with the Dalai Lama. So I drew on that, and I researched quite intensively the conditions in the house and where the Dalai Lama was living in his early months in exile. So it wasn't, and of course I'd heard my father all all his life tell me about when he'd first met the Dalai Lama. And my father was the one who took me first myself to meet the Dalai Lama when I was 17. So it wasn't so hard, I think, to piece together the details of their encounter. And you're absolutely right in terms of the second part of your question. When my father met the Dalai Lama 50 years ago, and when they began to talk, I think they were both hoping that people like them could form a kind of bridge between East and West, and so the mutual incomprehension between, for example, Asia and Europe or Asia and America would subside a little. And I think that has happened to a great extent over the past 50 years. We know much more about Asia, and Asia knows much more about us. But of course, you're absolutely right that there are still curtains all over the place. And I think the Dalai Lama impresses me because he's such a realist. And he never says, well, I expect all divisions to go away and all wars to end and all violence to disappear. He says there'll always be that kind of challenge and curtains of misunderstanding. But we can work hard individually to try to make them as transparent as possible and to work around those.
Yeah. But the character of the Dalai Lama, as you have known him and as you describe him, is so incredibly human. And this is borne out by what he is discussing relative to Buddha and Buddhism being here and now, contrasting it with the other great religions that have a paradise to which they strive without knowing exactly what that paradise is. In fact, the Dalai Lama and a Buddhist is the most in touch with his inner and outer beings, I would think.
Well, you're absolutely right. He loves learning from other religions, and he thinks that learning about Christianity and Judaism and others can actually deepen his understanding of Buddhism. So he's interested to hear about other notions of paradise, but you're absolutely right. He is almost like a scientist. In fact, I was once traveling with him in a train across Japan, and a journalist came up and asked him, as many journalists might, Your Holiness, what would you do to solve the problem in the Middle East? And he looked at him and said, well, there's no way I can solve it. I'm just a human being. And then he went on to say that the Buddha himself, of course, was just a human being and a scientist conducting various experiments. And I think one of the most interesting aspects of the Dalai Lama as a spiritual leader is, just as you say, that he's constantly, almost like a scientist with a microscope, looking at here and now to see what it is and to see what can be made of it, but not losing himself in the future, which we don't understand, or the past, which we can't change, but very much attending to this moment. And you're so right in saying that he's a human. I think many people, when they meet the Dalai Lama, before they meet him, they're a little apprehensive, understandably, because they're going to meet the head of Tibetan Buddhism and a lifelong monk and this eminence of great purity and authority. And as soon as he comes into the room, he'll pull their ponytail or tickle them or do something with their cheek, and one way or another dissolve all the formality and the difference and somehow make you feel, well, I'm not just meeting the head of Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, I'm meeting a great friend and a human being who's dealing with the same things as myself.
Yes, and yet he comes from centuries of mysticism as far as the world's concerned, that he has been almost a mythical figure to other peoples, other religions, for the Dalai Lama is just almost somebody who never really existed except in the minds of men who had heard about him.
Exactly. And I think he always tries to demystify himself. And in fact, when he gives lectures around the world, the first thing he will say is that if you've come in search of seeing a mythical person or a miracle or a maker or a magician, you've come to the wrong place. I'm just a human being and I've got a cough. And if I could perform a miracle, I wouldn't have this cough today. I'm just like you. And I think that's the particular power that the Buddha and Buddhism and the Dalai Lama have to offer. And I should say, I'm not a Buddhist, but I'm very impressed by this because, as you were saying, Jesus and some of the other great figures of religion are deemed to have to be agents of God or the son of God or the spokesman of God. The Buddha, by contrast, was just a regular human being. And what he was saying is that what he was doing is something you or I or any of your listeners could do if we choose to apply ourselves. And I think the Dalai Lama is always saying, I'm one of you. And if you're impressed by me, be impressed by yourself because you have the same potential. Mm. But you're right. When he says that, we still look at him through all the rose-colored glasses of Shangri-La and mythology. And we want him to be very special. And he says, no, I'm nothing special.
Well, the way you've planned the book, and that again is an interesting exercise, I would have thought, You have the divisions in public, in private, in practice, and each division has divisions into chapters of various things, the icon, etc. And the first division in public, you start as the fairy tale.
Yes, because so much of us, all for so many years, as you know, Tibet was the most unvisited, secluded place on earth. When my parents were growing up, fewer than 200 Westerners had ever set foot there, and half of those were part of a British military expedition. So it was the great unknown. And so we could project onto Tibet all our Shangri-La notions of monks who are living in a never-never land and a place of absolute peace, almost a literal rooftop of the world on a different plane from the rest of us. And one of the great challenges for the Dalai Lama is to say to us, this isn't a fairy tale place that is absolutely elevated and wonderful. It's a place of suffering human beings that needs your care and attention, and we are no different from you. And I think often the first thing that he says is, I don't believe in Shangri-La. I'm not from Shangri-La. And yet, I think Tibet will always have that fascination for people. And in some ways, the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans in exile have enjoyed the fruits of that because Tibet has a charisma that draws people in. On the other hand, they've sometimes suffered the consequences, which is that we instantly are worried about Israelis and Palestinians and Iraqis and other people we know in the middle of nitty-gritty real-world situations. But Tibet still seems to be a kind of haze in the mind that we don't think of as real.
Except in the mind of the Dalai Lama, who would know only too well of the cruelties visited upon each other in Tibet and then after the Chinese invasion. And yet he maintains this amazing equilibrium in a world that is out of equilibrium because of how much so many know and how little so many know and how to fuse the two and how he meets all walks of life. And his refusal to accept the form of deity, the living Buddha, as the Chinese, you say, refer to him. And then you go into a little bit of an explanation that he himself makes about led to his almost the most vehement response you heard him make was when there was this discussion about his Godhead. What was he? He was the living Buddha. He was a god. The Lama is the word for a guru. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, that was alluding to a mistake I made. More than 20 years ago, I went and wrote a long piece about the Dalai Lama for Time magazine, and I referred to him a couple of times as a living Buddha in that piece. And when I saw him a few years later, we were talking about something completely different, and suddenly he got this wild, mischievous gleam in his eye. And he said, you know, some Western writers and journalists refer to me as a living Buddha, and I could tell he was aiming that at me. And he said, that's completely wrong, because that's a violation, that's a profanation of what Buddhism is all about. And the whole point of Buddhism is that it doesn't think about gods. It doesn't say God exists or doesn't exist. It says that's immaterial. Let's look at the human reality. So for me to write about him as a living Buddha was really to make a mockery of his entire philosophy. And so he told me that very vehemently, as you said. And so I made sure when I wrote another article for Time magazine about him that I didn't say anything about the living Buddha. And then when the article came out, I rushed to the newsstands to see it. And there my editors had put the title, The God in Exile. And I thought, well, this is a small example of what the Dalai Lama is up against. He argued so precisely and rigorously for the fact that there shouldn't be no mention of gods, and I made sure to keep all mentions of gods out of my article, but there it was, editors in New York had given it the title, The God in Exile. But I think what you were saying before, if I may say quickly, is so absolutely correct, because I travel with him every year when he comes to Japan, and one of the things that's most impressive and interesting to me is that the first thing he always does is meet Chinese individuals, and all he wants to do is not to demonize the Chinese, but to try to come into closer contact and have as much dialogue with his seeming enemy as possible. And again, that scientific aspect in him. Recently, China has been oppressing Tibet rather violently. And when the Dalai Lama travels, he doesn't talk about that. He just asks everyone he meets to try to visit Tibet and just bring back an objective scientific report. And he always says, don't listen to Tibetan propaganda, don't listen to Chinese propaganda, just go and tell us scientifically what's really going on, and then we can attend to it.
Well, getting back to the title, Fairy Tales, you, at the end of that chapter where your article has been labeled The God in Exile by the editor, and I've learned over the years with newspapers here, when you're trying to get the gist of something in the papers, somebody writes the article, but somebody else does the title
Indeed.
Or the headline, which is completely different. But it's in part of the age of the image. And you're saying that this is what all the pseudo-gods of movies and television and sports, that you ended up, in fact, when you saw that, that humans are very reluctant to give up their fairy tales.
Yes. And I think it's we, the consumers and the viewers of the world, who want this simplified vision. When we follow our political campaigns or politics around the world, we try to turn the leading figures of the world into kind of figures in a soap opera, almost, who are as interesting and over-the-top as characters we might see in a movie. And, of course, the Dalai Lama, who is also seen as this wise god in the world of politics, he's always trying to bring us back to reality. And I would say that if the heart of the Christian religion is creation and God the Father and the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, the heart of the Buddhist philosophy is reality. That's almost what their altar before which they bow. And so reality is a very important thing for the Dalai Lama, and image is a very distorting thing, he would say. And it's interesting, when the Dalai Lama travels, one of the first things he often says is, dream nothing. Don't spend your time thinking about what could happen. Work really hard for what you can make happen tomorrow.
As you say, the essence, the purity, the achievement of being a Buddha is to be in harmony with where you are, who you are, and what is around you.
Yes, the very word Buddha means wide awake. So it means
awaken
to what's happening, as you say.
What does Dalai mean?
Dalai Lama is a Mongolian term, and it means ocean of wisdom, because it was the Mongolian Khans who first really set up this system many hundreds of years ago. And the Dalai Lama, when he's explaining this, will always say, I'm not an ocean of wisdom, it's just a term that has been placed on me.
But he does actually have a significance in terms of the English language. The word unique is overused, badly used, very unique, only unique. Unique is unique unto itself, meaning only one of a kind.
Mm.
And I think the Dalai Lama, by tradition, inheritance, and perception, is unique. There's no other Dalai Lama actually around when the Dalai Lama is so named.
No, that's beautifully said. No, you're absolutely right. And I would say further that this particular Dalai Lama is unique in the world right now because he's a monk who is a political leader. And I think that's an exciting thing, to have a monk from any tradition bringing the sense of clarity and far-sightedness and inclusiveness that we associate with monks into the heart of a very, very real world. And I think that's why he's such a good friend with people like, well, formerly Mother Teresa, but certainly Desmond Tutu in South Africa and other religious figures who've found themselves in the middle of the political world. But he is unique as a monk head of state, essentially.
Which leads me to ask you some questions that arose in my mind when I was reading this. Is it only male monk? Are there any female religious figures in Buddhism the way there are in several of the, like Mother Teresa, like the nuns who dedicate themselves to God? And can you only be a monk, a Buddhist monk, if you dedicate your life to this existence from the very beginning? Or can an adult attracted to Buddhism, immersing himself in this particular approach to living within oneself and in harmony with the rest of your actual existence, be a monk? In other words,
yes.
Do you have to be
yes.
born into it?
No, as in the Christian tradition, anyone can become a monk or a nun at any time in their lives, regardless of their background. And to answer the first part of your question, which is such a good question, there are indeed high lamas in the Tibetan tradition who are women. The Dalai Lama has said that the next Dalai Lama could be a woman or could be in anything, but certainly could be a woman. And I think one of the things he most relishes about being in exile is that traditionally women haven't been able to become abbesses in the Tibetan tradition. they haven't been allowed to get doctoral degrees or participate in ritual debating and some of the things that the monks do. And as soon as the Dalai Lama came into exile, he thought, well, now I can make improvements to our system and allow women all the same opportunities that men have. So he very quickly ensured it was completely egalitarian and that every woman in Tibetan Buddhism should enjoy all the same possibilities as every man.
Remarkable. Remarkable man. Are there any physical attributes or descriptions of his predecessors?
Yes, there are. And in fact, in the course of writing this book, one interesting thing was I found an account from the 1920s by a British diplomat who had become very close to the 13th Dalai Lama, the immediately previous Dalai Lama. And the 13th Dalai Lama came from a very different part of Tibet from the current one. He looks entirely different. His manner was different. He was dealing with very different circumstances. But as I read this book by the British diplomat, Sir Charles Bell, describing the 13th Dalai Lama, I found uncannily detail after detail were a perfect description of the present Dalai Lama. They were closer together, I thought, than George Bush Sr. and George Bush Jr. And it speaks for this interesting system of Dalai Lamas whereby there's no obvious connection between one Dalai Lama and a successor. And yet, invisibly, there seems to be a great continuity. So there are great descriptions of many of the Dalai Lamas, especially the two most important previous ones.
Which, of course, would lend some credit to those people who believe in reincarnation.
Yes, which is at the core of the Dalai Lama system, yes.
And which you say is not unambiguously absorbed or given any kind of universal acceptance. There are those who question its validity.
Yes. But, for example, when this Dalai Lama was chosen, he was found as a two-year-old boy by a search party of monks. And they went into a remote part of Tibet that's equivalent, let's say, to Sweden. And when he saw them, he came up to them at age two and started speaking to them in their language, which is as different from Swedish as Italian would be. And he knew all the details of their lives and of the previous incarnation, though he was only 2 years old. And so they administered a series of tests and realized that he had this mysterious connection with the Dalai Lama who just died, and he was the new Dalai Lama.
And then, of course, that just lends credence to this belief.
Yeah, well, yes, I think it's integral to at least the system of Dalai Lamas.
And it's always the inexplicable that those of us as bystanders, as onlookers, regard as miracles.
Regard as miracles, did you say?
Yeah.
Yes, and the Dalai Lama, if he were talking to us now, would probably say in Buddhism, his kind of Buddhism, there are no miracles. Either it's scientifically proven or it isn't. And in fact, the last time I saw him, which is a few weeks ago in Japan, I asked him about that. And I said, you know, there are lots of things in Buddhism that seem very mysterious to us and inexplicable. And he said, I quite understand that, but we have our own system of science and we're subjecting them to scientific tests, and they are explicable. If they were inexplicable, we would have no interest or confidence in them.
Well, I'm looking at, and this is one last question relative to that, in that first chapter of In Public, you're in Japan. It's written in the present tense. And after a meeting, he's on his way somewhere else to the next stop, and he sees a little group where a girl of 10 or so, with a mop of black hair and thick glasses, her legs in bright striped socks barely reach the ground from the wheelchair in which she is sitting. And he goes toward her, leans to her to talk to her. What is her problem, he asks the woman, is told that her eyes are fine, but the use of her legs is gone. And he just looks at her, leans forward and places his head against her cheek, looks at her again, says something else, and leaves. And the mother of the girl is dabbing at her cheeks, and the little girl is swinging her legs back and forth as if the day is just beginning. Now, if that doesn't sound like a miracle, how does he explain that?
And I must say, there the culprit is me, because I misdescribed that section a bit, which is to say, they meant that the use of her legs in terms of walking was gone, which is why she's in a wheelchair. So I didn't didn't do justice to that scene. I wasn't meaning to suggest that he had given her back the use of her legs, as
it reads
in the kind
like
of miracle
that,
that Jesus performed. But I did mean that he has an almost uncanny radar for compassion. And when he, and I've been traveling with him for 35 years, and when we walk into, let's say, a crowded arena where there are 3,000 people and they're all standing up to clap and greet him, and, you know, I following along with him and just amazed by the crowd, he will suddenly, out of 3,000 people, see somebody on crutches on the side. Or even though he's meant to be going up to the podium to speak, he will see a child in the wheelchair and instantly make a beeline for her and instantly just talk to her and touch her and bless her and give her what he can. And he would say that he can't give her back the use of her legs or her eyes or whatever she's missing, but he can offer her something by way of human warmth. And it's very moving. A few years ago, I was traveling with him in Japan, and we climbed up a hill to go into a temple. And as we got to the top, a young Japanese woman stepped forward and said, "Lama, Dalai Lama, I need to talk to you." She was, you know, a typical heckler and troublemaker. And of course, the security carried her away. And I went into this temple with the Dalai Lama, and we sat there for a few minutes. And as we sat there, we could hear her shouting and screaming outside. And when the Dalai Lama came out of the temple, to my amazement, he turned to his bodyguards and he said, "Please bring her to me." You know, I think most of us would want to be as far away from a heckler or troublemaker as possible. But he said, "Bring her to me." And the bodyguards found her and brought her to him. And the Dalai Lama just looked in her eyes and held her cheeks and more or less conveyed to her, "Don't worry, you have nothing to be afraid of. I have nothing against you. We're friends. We have as much in common as apart." And it was a remarkable instance, both to see somebody reaching out to the person who seemed to be disrupting the occasion, as I think few of us would do. And also, I think it spoke at a deeper level for his real interest, which is dialogue. If somebody seems to be attacking you or opposing you, don't give them the cold shoulder. Don't turn away, but move towards them and see what common ground you can find. And that's what he's done with the whole Chinese nation, and that's what he did with this heckler. But it's a very humbling and, as you, I think, suggested, inspiring thing to see.
Yes, and that explains his reaction to the American reaction to the disaster of the Twin Towers.
Yes, where he sent his deepest condolences to President Bush and the whole of America, but he also said, "Please be careful before you respond, because the world is constantly changing from the Buddhist point of view, and the people who are your enemies today may be your friends tomorrow. And if you launch an attack in vengeance, then your enemies will probably launch another attack in vengeance against you, and then the cycle of violence will just go on and on. And at some point, the only way to heal such a situation is to break the cycle of violence."
Of course, and that is so obviously clear at the moment, so... Well, thank you, Pico. I will look forward to meeting you. Tell me, when you said the first time you met him in the Himalayas.
Yes.
And Dharamsala, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, Dharamsala, yes.
Dharamsala. Where is that relative to, it's in northeastern India?
Yes, it's 300 miles north of Delhi. Very, very difficult to get to. It's a long overnight train ride. And it's actually not very far. It's about 100 miles as the crow flies from the border of Tibet. So it's the northern part of India where it's very close to Tibet.
Yeah, because we lived in, various places. My father was in the army, and so I was at school in Kashmir. And,
you were very close then to... Gosh, lucky you. I would have loved to see Kashmir.
Yes. What part of India were you born? And
I've never lived there. You know it much better than I. I've never lived a day of my life there. I was born in England, in Oxford, and then grew up in Oxford and here. So it's a completely foreign country.
Isn't that amazing?
I don't speak a word of any language.
Your family originally was from what part of India then? Your parents?
My mother is Gujarati and my father from Tamil Nadu, but they both grew up in Bombay, so Bombay is sort of my family home.
Because Tamil is more southeast India, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, southeast India,
Madras.
And my mother, north India.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to meeting you.
So nice to talk to you, and thank you very much for including me in your program.
Oh, that's my pleasure. That was Pico Iyer, companion for 2 years, walking with the Dalai Lama. And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UA Little Rock Public Radio.